everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that's going to Kathmandu, because we really, really going to. If we ever get out of here, we're going to Kathmandu. I'm Dave Babbitt.
I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir.
And yes, welcome back to Filmstrips. This is indeed the podcast in which each and every episode we take a look at a film, we dissect it, we pull it apart, we see what makes it tick, dive into the nuance and subtext if it so happens to be there. The only thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
Well, last week was one for the record book. We were looking at Taylor Hackford's 1997 film, The Devil's Advocate, which in addition to featuring what we determined was peak Al Pacino, it also featured a co-leading performance by one Keanu Reeves, who we are following this week to a very strange place indeed. In fact, it's a place so strange that we even picked up a hitchhiker along the way.
That's right. So who is joining us in the backseat this week? Would they like to introduce themselves?
Oh, sure thing. Hi, everyone. I'm Ross May, and thank you for having me on to come talk about Kindergarten Cop. I'm very excited.
Oh, if only. That would be a movie with fun and laughs, or at least you could crack wise and not worry about being sacrilegious by accident. No, instead, sadly, we are looking at 1993's Bernardo Bertolucci film, Little Buddha.
Wait, you're saying I'm not here to talk to you guys about an Ivan Reitman film?
No, Ross. Instead of hosting your excellent podcast, Right Man for the Job, and helping improve our show's paratext by being really rapid with Simpsons quotes, no, instead we have decided to look at a film that has absolutely nothing to do with Ivan Reitman. Unless, Dave, can you think of a connection?
Okay, folks, there's a story here. Way back when, earlier in this year, I was talking to Ross on Twitter, as I want to do, and I forget how we ended up on the subject of Buddhism, but it came up. And you had mentioned, Ross, at the time, that you knew a little bit about it, and had offered...
A little bit is right.
Yeah. Yes.
What the French call un petit peu.
Oui, oui.
Sure, we'll go with that. Sorry, France. The key thing here is that when you made that offer, I made a joke about, okay, well, when we get to Little Buddha, we'll have you on.
Yeah, everyone, he what said, we should have you come on and talk about Little Buddha, a movie that, before you had mentioned it, I never knew this movie existed, so this is not one that I was familiar with before you talked about it, so I watched it. Yeah. And then I said, okay, I watched the film, so anytime you want to talk about it. And then David got back to me, oh, I shouldn't have made that joke. Just thanks.
Yeah, and we're also forgetting the most important part. I had to take 2 hours and 15 minutes out of my week to watch Little Buddha as well, which I had never heard of.
Yeah, yeah.
So... The important thing is, I owe two apologies off here. Lesson learned. Sarcasm online doesn't necessarily travel when there's no voice to
go
with. Yeah,
sarcasm doesn't work so well in print.
Yeah. But yes, having said that, we're all here recording at an ungodly hour to talk about Little Buddha. And that's mainly because I felt really guilty that I actually subjected you to this.
Well, that's the fun thing about this episode, though, because, you know, it's very rare that we can come across a film that neither you nor I have ever previously encountered. You might even say that we're a bunch of film nerds, and if even we haven't heard of Little Buddha, then I'm assuming nobody else has ever heard of it either. So, Dave, why don't you give us the rundown?
Little Buddha is the 1993 drama written by Rudy Wurlitzer and Mark Peplow, and directed by Bernardo Bertolucci. The film stars Chris Isaak and Bridget Fonda as Seattle-based parents of a young boy who a group of Tibetan Buddhist monks from Bhutan believe may be the reincarnation of one of their great teachers. When personal tragedy strikes, the boy and his father join the monks in a journey to Nepal to confirm the suspected reincarnation. Along the way, the story of Prince Siddhartha's quest for enlightenment is recounted. While a success in France, Little Buddha received mixed to negative reviews in North America and little in the way of box office success. Coming up after Filmstrips, Ted Wass stars in the classic spin-off from Camp Candy, Wass's Water Park.
Wow, Dave, what a wonderful description of this film. It certainly sounds exciting and inspiring and powerful. So I guess if we want to begin at the very beginning then, even before Dave's Twitter bet that got us all to this point, I suppose that begs the question of Ross, you have an anecdote to tell us about Buddhism, a crash course?
Sure, the tiniest crash course. To give everyone a heads up, I am not a Buddhist. I don't study Buddhism for enlightenment. Some people study religions, oh, maybe this will give me peace of mind, and apparently not me.
Somebody also just wants to flip through the pictures for an awesome album cover.
Yeah, you're right about that. My interest in Buddhism sort of started with understanding Asian stories. So like I read up on that, and I've read, for instance, a lot of people might be familiar with the Chinese epic Journey to the West, or as most people are probably familiar with it as, the Chinese novel that Dragon Ball is based on.
Yes.
Ah, yes.
And the video game Enslaved Journey to the West, featuring mocap by Andy Serkis, who's one of those few people we haven't looked at on the show previously.
Okay, yeah.
We'll
so I've done things, you know, I say that if I'm at the idiot's guide level of Buddhism, like I am that idiot. But let's talk for 4 hours now about Buddhism. Or no, I'll do it very quickly, the most basic little thing.
Well, we could do it CBC radio style. Now, Buddhism, that's a religion?
Yeah. Save your jokes to later. I'm looking at notes here.
You took notes. Okay. Well, then you're clearly much less of an idiot than I. I know nothing about Buddhism other than the stuff that you tend to see in popular movies. And if there's anything we've learned through almost 100 episodes, there's a real problem Hollywood has with non-majority representation.
Now, you're right about that, and that will come up in this movie as well. But anyway, yeah, so I've been to, you know, monasteries. I have not spoken extensively with any monks. I've been to places like Beijing and Hong Kong, which is very sad. Lots of awful things are happening in Hong Kong right now. California, I've been to a few monasteries. I think most people are familiar with, you know, the concept of Buddhas in general, which just to be a Buddha is just to be enlightened. And yes, everyone, there is more than one Buddha. This movie is, in the flashback sequences, is primarily about Siddhartha, but we'll get to that. That's why you see different statues and different images of different looking Buddhas, because there's the Jolly One, there's all different sorts. There's generally accepted to be 28 Buddhas.
28? Wow, three shy of a Baskin Robbins.
Yeah, and but I'll tell you the fun fact. Okay, movie time. We're all familiar with Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, correct?
Yes. Kind of. That's the racist one.
As opposed to the others?
Okay, valid point. That's the really racist one.
Okay, yes. Yeah. In the opening scene where the Chinese gangster wants the remains, he wants the remains of an ancestor, and they're switching a diamond for these remains, he's getting Nurhaci. Nurhaci was a warlord responsible for thousands of people dying, but Nurhaci, he claimed to be a Buddha, and like who's gonna argue with him? So I love that like here is this, you know, warlord, like, to give you a heads up, like what Indiana Jones is trading for there, it's would be worth more than any diamond, actually. Oh, you've got like the remains of Nurhaci, the Manchurian warlord, like that is a huge deal. But anyway, but he just said, like, yeah, I'm a Buddha, and all of his soldiers and everyone they conquered said, like, yeah, we're not going to argue with you. Okay, you're a Buddha.
Well, yeah, there's something to be said for speaking confidently and having a large horde behind
yes.
you.
Anyway, so I'll just getting to the point that, like, yeah, so in Buddhism, generally accepted there are at least 28, but there could be more. There could be a lot. It's sort of, not to make everything a comparison to, say, Christianity, but, you know, like the Catholic Church has, here is the canon, here are the definite, what we are saying are the definite saints. And then there are other churches, Eastern Orthodox and whatnot, say like, hey, we've got other saints. And anyway, so enough of a discussion about that. But what I really...
No, sorry, that just gave me this wonderful image in Times Square of guys standing on the sidewalk holding out sandwich boards going, saints, get your saints here! We got all types of saints. But I guess that sort of, I think as someone who knows very little about Buddhism, that kind of speaks to the one thing that I do know, which is it's a theistic system that recognizes reincarnation as, and sort of like the transmutation of essence as one of its central ideas.
That is my understanding as well. Yes. And yeah, so, To getting to my point about this movie, about Little Buddha. So most people are familiar with Buddhas, and if you're not, that's what this movie is entirely about. It's basically Sunday school, but instead of for Christianity, it is for Buddhism. But there is also a hierarchy, and one step down from Buddhas are called bodhisattvas. And bodhisattvas, they can attain enlightenment, but they have so much compassion for other people that these individuals have decided to remain in contact with the mortal world through some means to help humanity. So honestly, what I always say is that, honestly, to me, bodhisattvas sound a lot more admirable to me than straight up Buddhas, because they want to stick around and help people.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know about you guys, but if I was a compassionate person, I'd totally be a bodhisattva. I have seen that word before. I never knew what the distinction was. And that's a very interesting idea.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, more movie stuff. I have not seen Point Break, but isn't there? There's a character named Bodhi, right?
Yes.
Which is sort of like, and most people can recognize, oh, it's like Buddha. It's getting more towards, like, it's sort of in the middle there of the pronunciation of Buddha and Bodhisattva. So he's sort of, that character's presenting themselves as sort of one of these kind of figures. But so a thing that bodhisattvas can do is they will come back in the mortal form again and again to help guide other people. So if you wondered, say, who the Dalai Lama is, what that lineage is supposed to be, the Dalai Lama is supposed to be the main bodhisattva of compassion returning to Earth. That is so if you're like, why is the Dalai Lama an important figure? By the way, the Dalai Lama is not the only person. This is called a tulku system. In Tibetan, I believe I'm pronouncing it right.
Yeah, because I've heard is it a Panchen Lama? There are separate kinds of lamas within.
You've got it exactly right. Yeah, and Lama does not represent the fact that they are one of these returning bodhisattva figures. Lama is a sign of respect. It means actually a lot of the times in English we also use the word the word abbot, as in like an abbot of a, say, again, Christian monastery, which you mm-hmm. you want to be careful. You don't always want to cross compare one religion to another, but plenty of Buddhists,
yeah, don't cross the streams. See, we got to Ivan.
Thank you for that. Yes. but it goes to show, but like, even as far as I know, Buddhists have said that, like, no, abbot is a perfectly fine word. Lama just means, so not every lama, say reincarnates, but it is a sign. It's sort of like saying, you know, you are one of the elders of a certain monastery. But yes, the Dalai Lama is always, they are apparently on number 14, and the Dalai Lama is supposed to, 14 incarnations ago, attained enlightenment as a bodhisattva, and said, retroactively, and it was actually a few generations later when other Buddhists were saying, hey, we think there is a lineage here, and this lineage is called the Tulku system. And anyway, but the everyone, this is not a test. It's fine. David and I are both teachers. This is kind of why I get into this. But
hey, it's all right. I mean, I'm certainly willing to learn. And I mean, I think that's also speaking to, I think, certainly one of my concerns in approaching a film like Little Buddha, which, as we'll soon get into, is an incredibly earnest film.
Yeah.
Like, the thing is, I think, obviously, David and I don't always take an incredibly serious approach to films, but we also want to approach a film like this from at least a place of some understanding and respect. Like, I certainly don't want to be the guy that's riffing on this film simply because it's different than what I've encountered. Like, you know, so throughout this discussion, as a disclaimer, we don't know a whole lot about Buddhism. Please, when we say things that may come off as ignorant, we're really not trying to.
Yeah, that's a fair say. We're not Don Cherry, and we're not actively trying to tick off anybody here.
Way to date the episode, Dave.
And that goes for me as well, that everyone that...
Yeah, that's a blanket disclaimer. Don't worry, Ross, we got you covered.
Well, thank you very much. And that is that's basically the end. But I found that interesting, that a lot of people, they know of the Dalai Lama, but they're like, well, what's he about? And like, that is what he is supposed to be. He is supposed to be a bodhisattva, one step down Buddha of compassion. He is returning to Earth. He is leading people. And that is the other very important thing that you brought up, Andrew, is that he is not the only one, which is the main thrust of this movie, that they are going to go out and search for a different Lama who might have returned.
Well, yeah, like people think that the idea of reincarnation, in that sense, may sound crazy, but I mean, like, that's not a dissimilar idea to even like more quote unquote European theistic systems. Like the divine right of kings is all based on the idea of like transmuting God's essence through the throne. So, I mean, there definitely is some overlap there, which may explain why everybody in this film, is surprisingly eager to accept it. But yeah. So, Dave, where do we start with Little Buddha?
Okay, it probably behooves us to acknowledge that, yes, this is a film that is directed by, in this case, Bernardo Bertolucci. Now, most of you are probably familiar with him. If you're talking about more recent works prior to his death, I believe The Dreamers was one of his last films.
Oh, yes.
Certainly, yeah, put Ava Green, amongst others, on the map. Probably his most famous film, I think most people know by title, if not necessarily having seen it, is Last Tango in Paris. And again, that is a highly controversial film that maybe one day we'll get to, but needless to say, it is the film that introduced the notion of get the butter, which, oh boy.
Which, yeah, $2.99 this week at the Sobeys near my house. Limit 6 per customer.
Yeah. The key thing here is that Bertolucci is definitely one of the more acclaimed of the art house filmmakers on the international scale between the sort of late 60s, particularly in the 70s, and then going through into the 90s. And 2000s.
Yeah, because I think previously Dario Argento is the only Italian director we've really looked at.
Unless you want to start including Machine Gun McCain, whose director I can't remember, but I don't think we're going to go to that.
Yeah, so I mean, we haven't really talked about Italian cinema, and we'll probably do that more next week, I would imagine, than doing it here. But Bertolucci definitely comes out of the post-war Italian art cinema movement. You have figures like Michelangelo Antonioni. You have, I don't know who else you would include in there. But yeah, he becomes known for making very stylized, like they sort of straddle this divide between like surrealism and neorealism in a very expressive and colorful way.
Well, yes. And the thing about that's interesting, I think, about Bertolucci for us in this context is a couple points. One, by all accounts that I have been able to find online, he is an atheist. He was interested in meditation, and I'm assuming, and I could be incorrect on this, that his interest in Buddhism as a film subject was something that originated out of his interest in meditation itself. So the idea of an atheist coming to this subject matter and producing the film that we're ultimately going to get into here in a minute is kind of fascinating and also a bit inexplicable in some ways.
Well, you know, people go to London, England for a weekend conference, and then they come back with a bit of the accent. It just happened to me as we speak.
You flew off to England just now. Amazing.
Yes. It's a theater of the mind, guys.
Okay, but the key thing is, number one, yes, there is that aspect of Bertolucci. The second thing that's worth noting is this is not the first film that he made dealing with subject matter along these lines. Prior to this, in the late 1980s, he ended up directing a film, The Last Emperor, which again was dealing with Buddhist themes and dealing with a culture that he is most certainly an outside perspective
okay,
of.
Okay, wait a second, because I'm having a very white moment. So, okay, Bertolucci did The Last Emperor. I thought he did Kundun. Was that the Scorsese one?
That's the Scorsese
one. Okay, because I also couldn't tell if they were the same movie.
Well, but this is the thing. I mean, Bertolucci had great acclaim with that film, and I believe it's 87 that one comes out in. The key thing here is, okay, you have that, and then he comes to make this film, which is technically a release in 93. I'm assuming that's the international release, because otherwise everything I'm seeing seems to suggest that it came out in 1994 stateside, or North America, as it were. So pick and choose your dates on this one. The key thing, though, is that this film did not come out to the same degree of critical acclaim, and it seems to have been, from what very nebulous information I've been able to find about its production, a little bit troubled in the sense of this was a film released by Miramax, our good friends there that we will try and avoid reminding everybody of the various crimes its heads at the time.
Well, it's not like we worked there, or at least I didn't. I don't know about you, Dave. How many burner phones do you have?
I was 9 or 10 at the time, so only one. Point being,
smart, you're too young to have criminal liability attached. Go on.
Indeed.
How convenient.
Yes. The key thing here is that there was apparently some, from what I understand, a bit of tug of war over the final shape of the film before it was released. But the key thing here, I would say, that's of a note of most interest is that this is, even though it's an international co-production, it's much closer to Hollywood in terms yes. of both its resources and in terms of the figures that ends up factoring this, because
yeah, like Ryuichi Sakamoto.
Well, okay, not everybody, but in this instance, yes, we do. This is a film that stars Bridget Fonda, an actor that I honestly think most people tend to forget exists because she's basically been retired for about 2 decades now at this point in time. And Chris Isaac, who's returning from his appearance in That Thing You Do yes. for this movie, in a surprisingly large role, we'll get to him in a bit. And probably our big connection for this one, and likely given the timing, the biggest star that was in this movie, given that this is coming off of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Bogus Journey, and Point Break, Keanu Reeves, in a, as we've already acknowledged, a very interesting role, and oh boy, this is going to be problematic when we get into it, not to say the least. But yeah, I mean, this is a film that effectively comes out, doesn't do terribly well critically, unless it was in, except for in France, of all places, where, as I understand it, this was the highest grossing movie of France that year. So I, again, I, showing the differences in terms of international cinema compared to what goes on in North America. Well,
but that's the other thing, David, because like from frame one, this really, at no point does this strike me as a film that would premiere at Cannes. And I think Ross's descriptor of this film as a Sunday school movie for Buddhism, I feel like that, once you affix that label, it's hard to see this film as anything but.
Well, and you're not wrong. And I mean, Roger Ebert, in his review for this film, made a very similar claim towards this movie, where his review overall was fairly negative towards this film. And yeah, part of it was that he saw it as a fairly devout film and kind of bizarre, given that, yeah, this is coming from Bertolucci, somebody who, again, is traditionally a more adult filmmaker, and yet here he is producing a film that...
Well, you know, Roger Ebert is always going to take half a star off if the ladies don't get their tops off. Just saying.
All right, fair point.
Read his old essays. It's written all over the place.
I
miss Roger Ebert. I've talked before about how influential that book is.
Yeah, yeah. But Roger Ebert aside, I guess this does bring us to discussing the film proper. And I mean, the thing of it is, right from frame one, and I'll toss it to you, Ross, and see whether you have the same reaction. Like, this is a film which opens up with basically voiceover narration and the recounting of, I don't want to call it, it's not quite a fable, more of a sort of moralistic lesson being presented in the terms of a story towards a group of children in
a parable, perhaps.
That would be the word I was striving for in this instance, who, and again, it sets the film off in this very interesting direction that the rest of the movie seems to follow, where it feels that in its address, this is a movie aimed at children, which it doesn't really lose for the rest of the movie. Is that sort of a fair assessment, would you say, or at least from the way you were reading it when you took a look at it?
You know, it sure seems like you're right, because we're going to talk about children that have, that might possibly be the reincarnations of a deceased llama. But yeah, you're right. It starts off with a story that I am not familiar with, but you know, like Buddhism has several, you know, parables like that. But I think just right off the bat, that story there is just introducing to you the idea of We're in a different country. We're over in Bhutan. Yeah, we're in a monastery, but also we're going to teach you about Buddhism, and they believe in reincarnation. Because, you know, hey, there's probably a lot of people who have not just heard that sentence. Buddhists, here, there's a belief in reincarnation here.
Well, yeah, especially in 1993, maybe different for international audiences, but I think certainly for a domestic American audience, Buddhism is not quite as, at least, present in the popular consciousness as it is in 2019.
Yeah, I was just going to say about the focus on children, like, you can't get away from that because they're going to look at kids who they're wondering, is this child the one that we are looking for? Is this child the one we're looking for? So there's that. But also, you can't get away from the idea that if you're going to introduce a concept, it doesn't have to be a religion, but in this movie it is. If you're going to introduce an audience to a religion, so yeah, and that we've already tipped our hands at this, like, that's one of the faults of the movie, is that it is, yeah, it's a story, but the point of it is not the story. The point of it is to teach, you know, a lot of Western audiences about what Buddhism, some facts about Buddhism, that an easy way to do that is a lesson, and a lot of lessons, you know, like, not dissimilar from how you would teach children. And it's, I don't think a fault is that it particularly talks down, but, you know, it keeps things simple. The I'll save pits for later, like it's lacking of story details and all that. But yeah, so it's so preoccupied with, okay, here are some kids, even if they are not the stars. And then we are going to teach audiences about, here's the story of Siddhartha and stuff like that. So you're absolutely right. So right off the bat, you think, oh, is this a kid's movie? And I guess it really fits probably under the idea of it is a family movie, if it's anything. But, you know, that's what it is.
It's a film that hops modes very frequently, and I think to its detriment. I think it's pretty clear what the film is trying to do in setting up a parallel structure where, as we soon discover, a group of monks end up coming to America and they meet Jesse, a 6-year-old boy that may be the newest iteration of one of their teachers. That is intercut with the progressive story of the life of Prince Siddhartha, played by Keanu Reeves. And yes, we will talk about how he plays that role. But I mean, the problem is, it's just, this film wants to be many different things. And I think, whether consciously or unconsciously, frames itself as very different movies in 20-minute intervals. And I think if it just chose one of them, it would be a more sensible film to talk about, and a more enjoyable film overall.
Well, I think there's a couple points worth talking about here, because you're right in the sense that in terms of the issues and concepts and focus of the story, you're right, that constantly shifts. But the actual address towards the audience never leaves behind that very direct earnestness towards the audience, where it's like, no, we're saying what we mean, and there's not going to be any irony here. There's not any sort of hidden agendas going on with this film.
And that's what baffles me, because this is a movie directed by Bernardo Bertolucci, who made The Conformist. It's written by Rudy Wurlitzer, who did Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and Walker, which is one of the most interesting films I think I have ever seen. You know, it's shot by the guy who did Apocalypse Now. It is so strange that this film is completely earnest through and through.
Well, and what makes it all the more confounding, I mean, it's very clear, to me it feels like the audience for this movie, and this is where its popularity in France sort of confounds me, is that it's very much directed at what feels like an English language, if not outright American audience. Because the one thing we didn't acknowledge here is that you would expect that when we have a sequence, you know, set in another country with a group, with these monks, that it's going to be a case where they are not speaking English. Everybody in this film speaks English from frame one. There is no subtitling of the dialogue at any point in this film.
Yeah, so, this is a very, you are absolutely right that this is for Western audiences, but there you go. To me, like, when I watch, say, The Last Emperor, which I really see the connection there, that you were talking about Bertolucci's interest in meditation. There's also, like, he obviously got interested that we are not in China. We're never in China in this movie. But, yes. Like, you know, like, he's sort of like, okay, I'm I've got to focus on Asia, on including some actors that I've met filming Last Emperor, stuff like that. He's got this focus over there. And if you know The Last Emperor, which it's a beautiful movie, it's also, it's a weird thing. I would say The Last Emperor is probably a very good, I mean, it won Oscars, right? Like it is a good movie for Western audiences. And any Chinese, any Hong Kong, Taiwanese audience is going to look at that like, this comes off as kind of cartoonish. People, they all speak English.
Yeah, sort of Crouching Tiger syndrome, where a big part of its appeal to Western audiences is this sense of exoticism that, domestic Asian audiences do not recognize as special and do not really care for, no matter how much Jing Shalit may say otherwise. Mm.
I think you're absolutely right. And to an extreme degree, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, like that was popular over there too. Like people enjoyed that. But The Last Emperor is really like, that's to an extreme degree. Like this is for Western audiences. We're going to teach you things. And then like characters will describe things that no Chinese audience would need described to them.
Yeah.
So it goes to show that, like, you know, what makes a good movie. And today, usually, oddly enough, about when in regards to China, we talk about how things have to be made universal, how they have to travel to another country. But there you go. What might be ultimately, you know, a good movie for North America, for Europe, that it comes off as quite childish to other audiences who are more familiar with that subject matter, which I find that carries over a little bit over into this. Like we know from the jump what its intention is. Yeah. To teach.
Yeah. So I guess, how then does this film teach us then? Because I guess my question then is squaring that up with the actual narrative of this film. Because, yeah, there's this discussion at the beginning, and then we get the monks coming to America. And, like, I feel like this is another film exists in a parallel reality where the entire film is, like, jungle to jungle and a fish-out-of-water comedy as the monks are searching for the love in the big city of Seattle. But that's not what we get. Like, we get some light comedy as they travel, but, like, it's all very dignified.
Well, this is the thing. Like, the film very quickly sets the stakes. And here's where I think we start to get into where the problem with this film lies. Because you're right. We open up focusing on the monks as they come over in order to find the potential reincarnation of their teacher. And they end up predominantly represented by Ying Yuchun. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing the actor's name correctly there, who's playing Lama Norbu. And basically, they've already sort of identified where the location is because of a dream. One of the more, the ones who were living in Seattle here, has had, where, yeah, they identify from this particular hilltop where an architect has built a home for him and his family to live there. And now, this is where things get interesting because, okay, you would think right off the bat that when you're going to have a family come into contact with these monks who are basically coming around to sit there and say, hey, we know you don't practice this religion, but
can we borrow your son for a bit?
Well, effectively, yeah, they're basically saying, it's like, we think he might be our a reincarnation of one of our great teachers. Can you help us bring him over so we can actually just put this to the test and see if this is the case?
Yeah, so the mother in this case is it Lisa?
Yeah, played by Bridget Fonda, and
her character consists of glasses and a slightly worried look.
Well, worried or detached, it really just sort of depends upon the scene we're talking about, because
she's like Pacino's wife in Heat.
Yeah, but she basically talks to this monk at, I believe it's a soccer game, if I'm remembering correctly, where her son's playing in, or is it a baseball game? Point being, he's playing there, and he starts asking a series of questions about, when was your son born? Now, what time of day? And
now here's where in a parallel universe, it becomes an unwanted visitor type movie, like The Box or something like that, where instead this woman is slowly gaslit and driven mad by these really friendly monks who seem to have sinister intentions to her son.
Well, if this were a film, told from her point of view, that might be the case. But in the case of the monks, we know right off the bat, these are well-intentioned individuals. Like, there's no malicia to them. But the problem is that the film assumes that she has that knowledge on her own, and she just sort of goes along with this, and then when they show back up a week later at her house with Norbu, who's traveled all this way to meet her and to meet their son, she doesn't really react. It's like, oh, come inside, have fun. No, I'm going to send our babysitter away, or caretaker away for now, and it'll all be fine.
Well, I also do love how the film establishes that they're still unpacking boxes, but they already have a maid.
The sending the maid away in particular, which, there you go, this is a family that has a maid in this giant house that the architect dad built himself. But yeah, like, you're absolutely right that the movie understands, we, the audience, understand, like, oh, these are friendly monks, they mean no one any harm. But, like, the attitude of the mom, yeah, Lisa, that oh, the maid, oh, you can go, that there was a, there, I think both of you guys are recognizing that there is an opportunity for drama right off the start, where maybe she doesn't want to let these monks in right off, because they're asking strange questions, or that, like, no, you can go, like,
I think it's more like that sort of earnest faith in everyone's good intentions. Like, they're, I don't want to say naive, because I wish we lived in a world where we could have faith in everybody. But, like, you know, this is a movie where it's like, oh, well, these are men of faith, and she can see they are men of faith, ergo, everyone's good. It's kind of like Frank Baum has one of the Oz novels where, like, he describes there's an army made entirely of women because no man would ever dare strike a woman. And it's like, that's just so well-meaning.
Yeah. But that's but you're quite right, Ross, where it really comes down to, they're not believable parents in the sense of, or at least if they're parents, they very much come from that sort of post flower power generation of the loose, very liberal parent that was sort of being made fun of in, or at least criticized in works like the original book version of Endless Love, before it was made into that terrible 1980s movie and then terrible 2010 remake. I can't claim the 2010 one, or 2010.
I think the issue is more one of just narrative plotting, because they're very welcoming at first, because that's what's required to have the long exposition about Buddhism and about the role that Jesse plays.
Yeah.
But then later junctures in the plot, in order to create conflict, we'll suddenly have characters behave very differently, and thus it comes off as facile during that first interaction, and then it just comes off as confusing later, and it feels inorganic. We're only suddenly, like, pulling away from the idea of learning more about Buddhism because we need to pad this narrative out a little more.
Well, absolutely. But speaking of introducing conflict, sort of, at this point, the Lisa's husband and Jesse's father, Dean, comes in the film, played by Chris Isaac, an actor who's, again, probably better known for his musical career, having produced a number of fabulous albums. I highly recommend people check them out.
Name a song he did other than Wicked Game.
Beyond that, Blue Hotel is certainly on there. We Let Her
Okay, you get a pass.
Yeah, We Let Her Down as well. The key thing here is that, yes, Chris Isaac is an amazing vocalist, and typically he's a pretty solid actor. His introduction into this film, and for the first half of it, though, you wouldn't know it, because man, oh man, is he stiff as he walks into this movie and is just sort of grumbling about scene by scene in very clipped monotone.
Hi, honey. What are these monks doing in our house?
Yeah.
It's like he showed up in full acting mode.
Yeah, and it's very weird. But it also, when the monks finally leave, and she starts, Lisa starts asking, it's like, well, why are you so upset? They're just a bunch of monks. Putting aside the fact that, yeah, you just invited a bunch of strange men into our home, you know, who are wanting to, talking about our son being the possible reincarnation of a teacher.
Yeah. If I came home and saw three guys, regardless of what they're wearing, just on the couch, I'd probably have a moment of, oh, who's this then?
Yeah. The key thing here is he then mentions probably my favorite element of this movie, and not in a good way. And that is Evan, because Evan's Evan has gone bankrupt, and this
Evan
is
makes the film worth watching,
which is very funny because everyone, because so let's oh this movie let's talk about Evan, let's talk about my business partner named Evan. We never meet Evan, do we?
No, his last name, his name is Evan Godot. But it also speaks to just the sheer confusion that this film has as a narrative, and the sheer confusion this film has in terms of its audience.
Well, yes, because the thing about Evan, and the basically what ends up happening is, over the course of not knowing Evan, we first learn that he's gone bankrupt. Never mind that we don't really know what Evan's relationship to Dean is.
We learn more about Evan than we learned about any of the principal characters.
True, but Evan's apparently gone bankrupt. This is troubling to Dean. Presumably they're in business together, and I'm going to assume they're close because...
Yeah, because doesn't Jesse say that Dean built that building with the dome on top, but no one rented any of the units?
Yeah, and that's about the extent of what we learn about the business troubles here, which is like, it's almost like they're gunning to do that red belt minimalism we were talking about, but it doesn't work one bit in this instance because it just takes away that much more context for anything. But
well, yeah, and it's here like, no one rented the units. Oh, did they not like the wallpaper?
Yeah,
you know, it's like, were you charging exorbitant rent? I don't know, that could be many things.
Was he in with the Open Seattle
the
mob
space Bertolucci? Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know, did you say something ignorant and get canceled? We know cancel culture is running amok.
Oh boy. Point being here that yes, with the whole point about Evan here is, yes, it introduces this thing that's bothering Dean, but even though, again, we've barely established who Dean is as a character, what we do know, however, is that Jesse has been left a book about sort of a children's storybook explaining the story of Prince Siddhartha. And yes, this is where we get into the other side of the movie, because yes, as we acknowledge, this story of Siddhartha is intercut with what's going on in the present day with the family. And okay, that's fine. I mean, here's a major figure, I'm assuming, in the Buddhist faith that they are going to explain to us. All right, that's fine. And here's the thing I'm going to say right off the bat about this. The Siddhartha stuff is actually, if this had just been a movie about that character and telling that story and doing that as sort of almost a... in the same way that we sort of see biblical epics, because the way Bertolucci shoots this and stages it, it's not that dissimilar from sort of the big production styles that we've seen of films like The Robe or The Ten Commandments, where, yeah, this is a big religious epic. It just so happens in this instance, it's not Christianity. That would have been fine. And I think this is some of the most engaging stuff in the film, as we sort of see this tale of how he went from being this prince to eventually becoming enlightened and becoming the Buddha in this instance.
Yeah, it's a sort of a riches to rags story. I mean, it's just because it functions at the level of mythic narrative. So, I mean, the Siddhartha arc, as far as it's concerned as a narrative, you know, it's nothing that you wouldn't necessarily expect. That being said, it is the most visually interesting aspect of the film, which kind of compensates for the thinness it has in terms of plot.
Yeah, you were about to jump in there, Russ.
No, I wasn't, actually.
Do it anyway.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're right that the Siddhartha stuff is really all more compelling. It's probably a good point here to point out, I mean, and this sort of gets into your wrap-up sort of stuff as well, but everything that's set in Seattle, it all has a blue tinge to it. So it looks very much, it's like the non-violent parts of Man of Steel. It's like, oh, yeah. Well, what's happening? Yes, everything is all blue. Well, obviously, like things look drab. They don't look nice in Seattle, even though I'm sure Seattle's a nice city. So the family's life in Seattle is, despite the fact that there's mom and dad and kid and, well, there's business problems, but there is something wrong and depressing about the way it looks. And then whenever you cut back to either Bhutan or if you go to the story of Siddhartha, it's more colorful. Particularly, they use more reds and oranges to just show that this is the real life sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And the cinematographer on this one is the legendary Vittorio Sorato. I'm hopefully not botching my Italian pronunciation of that, but this man, as we acknowledge, he shot Apocalypse Now, which right then and there should tell you the kind of top-tier cinematographer we're dealing with here. But yeah, I mean, the visual choice, again, sort of reinforces the sort of, again, that direct address that's part of the film, because it's very blatant and not subtle in terms of how it's sort of coordinating the visual look between the two different spheres, and how sort of Seattle, as seen by the family at this point in time, is the sort of cold and almost off-putting environment versus the warmth of the other parts of this movie. And it's no mistake that you see in the final shots of this film, again, spoilers for the end, but when you're getting to the final shots on the ocean back in Seattle, that there is sort of that warming up where the sun is now becoming more reflected in that, with that warmth in the final imagery of the movie. So it's gorgeous, if a little blatant in terms of what it's doing there. But yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. The Sedona stuff is visually gorgeous, Andrew. I mean, just a stunner to look at. And yeah, and again, it invokes elements of the sort of fantastic we don't see throughout the rest of the film quite explicitly. But again, it's not shot like a contemporary CG fest would be, where in this instance, all the effects are practical. And again, it's all very simple but visually striking things, such as the child version of Siddhartha walking and flowers blooming up right behind him in these instances. And it's very striking.
Yeah, there's visually almost a softness to the image as well. It visually, like, not to the same scale or magnitude as Ang Lee's Life of Pi, but like there's a sense of lushness to yes. the nature on screen. And yeah, there definitely is a much broader palette, including a lot of deep browns, such as the ones that Keanu Reeves is wearing on his face.
Okay, I knew we were gonna get there. Thank you for that segue. So yes, let's address the elephant in the room here. In terms of the cast and the Siddhartha sequences, most of them are individuals of much darker skin complexion, which makes sense here. So this leads, though, to the casting of Reeves, which I'm going to assume was probably, because from a financial standpoint, required.
That's the only reason it yeah. makes sense. Because given how little he actually gets by way of dialogue, you could very easily cast an actor that is much more, shall we say, suitable for playing Siddhartha.
That is absolutely the case. And there's no mistaking, Keanu Reeves is walking around on screen in brownface. There is just, you cannot get around that fact. So whatever good intentions may be there at the, in this film, that is deeply, deeply uncomfortable throughout every time you're watching this. So yeah, it's like, oh, here's these lush, gorgeous visuals for to watch, and there's Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, here's the better part of the film, and here's a reason why you can't totally give yourself over to it. I mean, some people can, but I think, Dave, you and I have firmly established that we cannot. And Ross, as a longtime listener and long-suffering listener, I'd imagine that you're probably of the same perspective.
I'm of the same mind, and also the whole internet and all of society loves Keanu Reeves, especially today. And you know what? I think from here we've just found this is reasonable to assume this is probably the most negative thing that Keanu Reeves has ever done, the most questionable thing that he's ever done. So, you know, this is his bottom, which, you know, I wish it wasn't there, but hey, that's good on Keanu Reeves that this is probably the worst thing he's ever done. I mean, in a moral or sort of social sense.
Yeah, it's tough because I feel like Keanu Reeves, especially in the way he performs the role, you can see he's trying, and I feel like he's trying to be authentic, but again, it's all a moot point because you are a Canadian and Chinese Hawaiian actor that is pretending to be of, like, Nepalese descent.
He's trying to be Indian, yeah, so the Siddhartha stuff is takes place in pre-unified India, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't totally sure because I'm absolutely terrible at geography. So, I know at one point, though, it does say Kathmandu, Nepal, and I'm like, I didn't realize they had merged.
We get to other places, too, but yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the key thing here, though, and I think this all speaks to an interesting thing, where, yeah, the thing with Reeves is, I mean, yeah, once you divorce that, he, I think, is honestly trying to come at this from a place of respect. I don't think that he took this on as a lark by any point. And he is giving it his all, and you can kind of see where why Bertolucci would see him as probably the lesser of the evils of having to cast a Western figure in this role.
Yeah, it's not Johnny Depp playing Tonto here.
Yeah, I mean, this is the case of Reeves coming in, and there is that, again, in terms of the performance he gives, he takes advantage of that sort of calmness to Reeves' performance, I guess for lack of a better term at the moment, where he is able to sort of project a tranquility at any given moment, and particularly the fact that the basic story of Siddhartha as it's presented in this film, again, I'm going to note straight up here, I have no idea if this actually reflects the actual texts that this is drawing upon, but is that effectively he is an isolated child by his father who does not want him to understand the hardships of life outside of the palace, and once
he's a bubble kid.
Effectively, and he sort of wanders into the world almost in a detached sort of, I don't fully comprehend this way. And once he starts recognizing that, yeah, the world is full of pain and suffering and ultimately death, even if reincarnation is something everybody believes in at this point, he sits there and says, no, I have to dedicate myself to figuring out how is it that people don't have to suffer. And yeah, it becomes a spiritual journey for him going through. And again, while acknowledging that Reeves is miscast in the role for a variety of very important reasons, his actual performance is affecting while watching the film itself, which is why it's such a frustrating thing where I feel bad on one end because Reeves should not be there, but I also can't sit there and say that the work he's doing isn't good on the level of what he's attempting to achieve here, and that just makes this all the more of a frustrating film as you're watching this play out.
Well, I mean, Ross, politics aside, I mean, I kind of assumed that would be Dave's take on it, but I'm curious about yours. Do you find that you can look at Reeves' performance and sort of separate that, or like, are you able to take in how he's playing the character on its own terms?
He gives a very good performance. Certainly he's trying to give a very good performance, but there you go. Like, probably to the three of us, his Indian accent probably sounds, oh, it's pretty good. But, you know, an Indian person is going to notice right off the bat that it is inauthentic in the same way that Apu from Simpsons was inauthentic.
Yeah,
which plenty of people have pointed out. It goes to, I think, definitely what I was saying before, that this movie, for all its good qualities and bad, that it is, there you go, it is directed at us. It is directed at white audiences in North America and Europe, and it's right with casting Keanu Reeves with all these sorts of things, like, it is not concerned with the wider world. And so it's sort of a continuation of, yeah, that happened in Last Emperor, even though not about casting, to my knowledge, and it's happening here. Yeah, but to us, he gives a good performance, which kind of goes, it's an interesting thought of, we usually think, we all know about the personal experience of, to me, does this movie, is it good or bad? But also, is it a good movie? Is a good movie it to white Canadians? Is it a good movie to Indian or Tibetan audiences? Probably not. Before we move on, when he goes out of the palace for the first time, that's a pretty good sequence. And it is a famous part of his story where, so his father, a king, totally shut out the old and the sick people. No one around in the palace was even allowed to mention that people get old or that they die. So which is a hard thing to understand.
It's like Logan's Run.
Well, what is it they all chant?
Man, imagine if old crazy Peter Ustinov showed up midway through this movie.
Oh, Jesus.
What is it that they chant in Logan's Run? I forget when they all go up.
Renew.
Renew.
Yeah.
Carousel is alive.
Yeah. Well, we all derailed this.
It happens. Yeah, his dad, the king, has this plan, like, okay, my son really wants to get out of the palace right now, but I'm going to set up things perfect for him. So everyone in town, if you're old or if you're sick, get out of town. Like it's all, okay, so everyone's cheering, and they're all cheering for Prince Siddhartha.
Yeah. Isn't that what they do with Catherine the Great as well?
I'm not sure.
Oh, I don't know that story.
All right, I'll look into that for next week, but go on.
Okay, yeah. And but he spots two old men with white beards off, like trying to, and they're trying to be nice. They're trying to cheer for their prince. He's like, whoa, I've never seen people with beards like that before. And then he gets out and he goes around the town and he sees, and this is a famous part of his story called the four sights. The four sights that he sees about, this is what the world is really like. And first he sees old people. He's like, well, what's up with them? And then finally his best friend, the one who is usually his chariot driver, who goes like, okay, the jig is up. I gotta tell you, there's this thing called old age. We all get old. Oh, okay. And then he goes around town. He's like, what's wrong with that person over there coughing in the corner, like, under a mat? It's like, well, they're sick. You see, sometimes people get very sick and you can recover, but not always. And like, what happens if you don't recover? And then they go see like, a family. They're grieving for a dead relative. It's like, this is called death. Which is, you know, it's a hard thing to first accept. Like, it's a state of non-being. Oh, okay. What's not commented on is as they leave their journey through the city, is he sees the last sight is a holy man. That is the fourth sight that he sees, and that Siddhartha becomes inspired and says, oh, I'm going to become a holy man to understand all these things and how to conquer old age and sickness and death. So the last sight, and you see, I think he's on a river, you see an ascetic. A man, ascetic, by the way, it just means a person who is trying to deprive themselves of as much as possible and to try to achieve a better state of consciousness.
Yeah, oddly, the belief of ridding yourself of the material realm. Yes,
oddly enough, when you starve yourself, you frequently hallucinate, and so you might have visions, and you might become, who am I to judge? But you might like. Oh, I had some visions. I met some relatives, or I met some spirits. Maybe I feel enlightened now. When depriving yourself of nutrition often gets you into that state. And so that is Siddhartha has come face to face with three aspects of reality, but the last one is, oh, he's got hope now. He's got his life's mission, which I think is a good sequence. Yeah, and it shows. Yeah, again, Keanu Reeves. He's doing a good job in this movie for what he can do. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a striking sequence. And again, probably the best sequence up until we get to the showstopper, where we see sort of the storytelling and what's happening with the kids in present day merging later on. But we'll get there.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. But the big thing here is while this is going on, ultimately, the way that the story is carrying forward for everyone else is that Jesse, who is this little moppet who apparently has no personality and is just sort of, huh, I'm nice. I'm always nice.
I'm precocious.
Yeah.
Very nice. Yes.
Yes. Basically does take an interest in this. And again, in questionable parenting at this point, they just decide to drop him off at a center with the monks to sort of.
I noticed that again, the total non-threatening nature of the monks to the parents, and like, yeah, sure, come into our home. That's fine. Which, like, you know, you might let people into your home sometimes, but it's the idea of, oh, the maid, you can leave. I don't need any other company in the house right now. When they meet up with the monks again, yeah, it's not, hey, the mom or dad or one or both of them are going to stay with the son and, you know, explore the monastery that they're fixing up and that like learn some things and get to know these monks better to have a better sense of trust. No, they just they'd leave him there, which yeah. even for early 90s, I'm thinking, don't do this. OK, but they do.
Yeah, there's a fine line between helicopter parenting and being totally irresponsible. And these parents are certainly closer to that total irresponsibility side of things. But yeah, based upon Jesse's ability, sort of recognition of the one bull is belonging to the teacher in his previous life, they believe that no, Jesse's probably a pretty decent candidate. And when Dean comes to pick him up, we get an interesting scene where Dean is again, how sort of painfully awkward this movie is at points. Dean explaining how he understands the situation with China and what has gone on there, which, okay, I mean, you're really taking a lot for granted for an audience where you're explaining Buddhism to them, but now you're not going to explain the overall political implications of this.
And that's a curious absence, because especially, Tibetan Buddhism, I mean, Dave, you and I, we grew up age when, you know, bands would scream free to that. And even though we didn't totally knew what that meant, we still heard it a fair bit. So it is, like, obviously this film cannot get into politics with the wholesomeness of its presentation and that focus on, like, the universalist message of Buddhism.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, it's weird, though, that Dean is willing to address it and not address it at the same time. It's just like, listen up, monks. I got no beef with the PRC. That's between you and them.
Yeah. Just, sorry, you were jumping in there, Russ.
Yeah, you're right. It is kind of a lame moment in there, too, in terms of the character. However, it is actually kind of a remarkable, as slight as it is, to feeling the need to address that, because I think they do. They think they that Bertolucci feels that he needs to address that. That no, the Tibetan monks, that they are Tibetan in that that is their school. However, they're not allowed to be in Tibet anymore. They had to flee from China, which is controlling Tibet at the moment. But I don't think a lot of people might not appreciate that. That is a big shift from Bertolucci, from the last emperor working with the People's Republic of China to film that movie. That was the first big Hollywood Chinese production, was it not? And then to shift over to this, and I can't assume that I didn't have enough time to read up on China's reaction, because China has a reaction to a lot of things. We know this. But I can't imagine that they would be happy with this film in, okay, we are just gonna, which seems totally innocuous to us, that, oh, we're going to focus on these monks, but they are monks specifically who we do not live in our homeland anymore. And to even have that sentence in there, I'm just going to take a guess. Everyone can look online yourselves, or I can look online too later. Like, I doubt that this movie played in China, which is a big shift after The Last Emperor.
Well, I was actually, well, you bring that up, Russ, and here's a good question. Would you almost think, having seen both these films, is there something about Little Buddha that in and of itself might almost be an apology from Bertolucci for that, which might explain the sort of earnestness of this film, the fact that there is no sort of levels of irony or complexity that he's bringing to this where we're asked to interrogate anything, only because this almost feels like I'm making up for something like that. Or is this, that may be a stretch.
But how much of a statement can a film be if, as you say, there's no irony or complexity to it?
True.
If this is a pushback, it's a very defanged one.
Fair You're absolutely point. Right about that. But yeah, that thought crossed my mind too, that definitely, I mean, but just by virtue of the fact of making, like we were saying, like this movie is defanged, it's fairly innocuous to us. That sentence right there was fairly innocuous and, you know, could actually be cut out. However, what they are actually depicting is that here are monks, which China would allow that, like, okay, you can show monks, but these are the Tibetan monks who are living in another country right now. Oh, that would be a problem to the People's Republic of China. And that you're absolutely right, that by doing this movie, Bertolucci is definitely saying in his career, like, he knows that he's not going to do another China co-production again, which I find is interesting in that respect. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Okay. Interesting. So I guess from here, what ends up happening is with this, Dean shows back up to the center, and in one of the more confusing moments where he suddenly decides that he has some form of parenting skills, when it's brought up to him, what they want to do is take Jesse back to, why am I blanking on the name of the country offhand?
Bhutan.
Sorry.
Well, the area they're going back to is Bhutan, yeah.
Yeah, to Bhutan. Basically, he points out, it's like, you know, here in the States, we call that kidnapping, which is making a huge jump from, well, you asked a question to, well, we'd like to do this. And it's like, well, that's kidnapping. Again, moderation, Dean. Moderation on these points. There is a fine center to be found in all things here.
Well, there you go. But he can't conceive of the idea of parenting, of watching his child while his child is at the monastery. He's like, well, no, like, of course, if I'm going to leave you with the monks, like, I'm going to go. I've got things to do. I'm going to look after, what's his friend's name? What's his co-worker's name? Evan?
Yeah. I have to look after Evan's failing
yes,
business.
My son can take care of himself. What? He's 8? He's fine?
Yeah. It's not like Evan can, as we soon learn. But on the plus side, it frees up the calendar for the trip. What is the point? Okay. Because while there's some vacillation, and then we discover that Lisa Okay, Lisa seems much more willing to go along with the idea than Dean, and there's that very tense exchange they have. But like the way that Dean frames it, he's like, look, learning is one thing, but like I don't believe in reincarnation, and neither do you. And she silently looks, do you? And it's like, I don't think belief in reincarnation right no. now is the issue. But that's an interesting way to reduce it all. But like, yeah, and then he's driving with Jesse, and...
Yeah, where he learns that something's happened to Evan, and after some prompting from Jesse, we know that Evan isn't around anymore. Poor, poor Evan. Granted, I think it's very strongly implied...
He moved to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, yeah. It's very strongly implied without ever coming out and saying that Evan's likely committed suicide, but at least that's the way I took it.
Yeah, because we get that very angsty shot of... And I think it's a pretty, like, the best shot yeah. in the domestic sequence of... Chris Isaac on the bridge with Jesse just framed from above looking over the traffic on the overpass. That felt like a very Vendors type shot, but like that's the only thing aesthetically from the Seattle part of the movie that really stood out.
Yeah, and I would say that, I mean, I'm very happy that the film didn't go the direction, because what ends up happening is Jesse comes out with the book, and then while his father sort of tearfully, I guess, contemplating about his time with Evan, Jesse starts reading from the book there. And I was fully anticipating this is going to be a moment where we might see a freak out from Dean where it's like, put that stuff away, you know, I don't want to hear about that. You know, just, it's all about...
Yeah, instead it's just like, hey, let's be way casual about Jesse moving on from Evan like that.
Yeah, so it's...
Dad, I don't want to mourn. Yeah, that's but, boring.
But what ends up happening is following another part of the Siddhartha sequences of the film, what ends up happening is, yes, Lisa and Dean have a conversation where Dean is all of a sudden, miraculously, without any, you know, sort of scenes indicating why, come around to the idea of him going with Jesse to back to the monastery, which Lisa all of a sudden decides to do a 180 degree turn. It's like, well, no, we can't take him there. We can't have this happen. And Dean's approach, it's like, look, you know what?
Yeah, the last time we talked about this, Evan killed himself.
Yeah, and you get, Dean starts explaining, it's like, I don't know, it might be good for him, and, you know, it'll be good for me. I get my head on my shoulders, think about what I'm going to do. It's not like, I mean, at this point, I'm going to be stuck with lawyers for the next few months. Which, again, begs the question of, like, okay, like, what exactly was Evan into? Like, I keep thinking that there's, like, this really, really shady things going on with Evan that we're not privy to that probably would make this film far more interesting in the grand scheme of things. But...
We need to see the cut with Evan, actually. And what actor is going to play this guy? He's the most one of the most important characters in the film, but... You know, I think the writers and Bertolucci, they're getting, well, we've already sort of said it, that the dialogue isn't that interesting. They think intellectually, oh yeah, I mean, it would be horrible if your business partner and friend killed himself. It's like, well, yeah, fine, intellectually we know that, but maybe you should show us Evan.
Exactly. It's like, because otherwise we're just presented with it, and like, it almost comes off as comical, because like, there's very little by way of like, emotional affect in the film, or at least between the characters, and then it's like, fine, you want to see that Dean has sensitivity? Boom, Evan's dead. All right, watch him be sensitive now. Are you happy? And it's like, that's not how characterization
See, what would make me
works.
Laugh all the harder is if it turned out that Evan was played by Kevin Costner, and this is the second big chill thing for him, where...
I was also thinking if Jesse was revealed to actually be the reincarnation of Evan.
Oh man, yeah, this film went on a really different path than what we anticipated. But yeah, I mean, effectively after this stirring, not exactly a speech from Dean, Lisa consents, and yeah, suddenly we cut to Kathmandu, sadly no Bob Seger, and in this instance, what we have here is, yeah, Jesse and Dean arriving with the monks, and they are coming back to sort of explore and go to the monastery, which leads to, again, more irresponsible parenting on the part of Dean.
Yeah, he just lets him go off.
Yeah, but But then it turns out that he's walking on a rooftop and has like a full vision of the entire market area,
I guess.
Just before we go on, like, and this is all good stuff, but just back to the scene of I care so little. I keep on forgetting the mom and dad's name. You've already said it.
Lisa and
okay,
Dean.
Okay, yeah. Well, they're having their conversation, and you're right. It's inexplicable that suddenly she is like, no, I didn't like. I was okay with him having an interest in Buddhism and visiting the monks unsupervised, totally. But going to Bhutan is a step too far. And then she says, and I'm a teacher. I have to stay and finish the year. And so Dean says, like, well, I'll go with our son. And she sort of breaks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to overlook this. She breaks down crying and she apologizes to him. I think she's apologizing for their little non-argument that just happened. But it is, whoa, it is. I'm not a person who looks out for misogyny all the time, but it is pretty like she was the supportive one throughout all the movie up until just one scene. And her only argument was, no, I think maybe Bhutan, like maybe I'm arguing against that.
Let's not send our son to Asia unsupervised. I'm sorry, that was very unfair of me.
Yeah, but that's the weird, like the thing that that seems very insidious to me is she starts saying I'm sorry to her husband over her recent attitude. I'm thinking like, that's so weird.
Yeah, considering it was Dean's position at the outset of the film. Let's also keep in mind that, like, they don't go to Kathmandu until what feels like the 3-hour mark in the movie, which is more than halfway into it, and yet there are still narrative beats that need to unfold as well.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And it's funny enough that we should also note that Lisa points out in the scene that Dean has never looked after the child on his own, according to her, which makes this all...
You were too busy building houses and watching Evans kill themselves.
Apparently. Well, I know why. Yeah. I know ultimately why, like, as a viewer, if I didn't know, like, well, why, apart from saying that she's a teacher, like, you could give her a different job. It would make more sense in my mind if both parents, well, if they were better parents, and they watched their kid, but also if they both said, you know, this will be a good family trip. We can all go with the monks together. She stays behind, and I understand why. The reason that they wrote her as staying behind is because they're trying to mirror the Siddhartha sequences, where Siddhartha goes with his one friend out into the world. And in fact, on the plane ride, you said, like, cut to Kathmandu, which is good. There is one scene in there where it's an airplane trip, and suddenly for the first time, the dad and son, they are bathed in, like, warm light. And
yeah,
they're bathed in warm light, and this is nice. And then everyone on the plane falls asleep. That's very nice. And it's only the son and Norbu, the main monk, that they are awake and talking, which is, in real life, it just means they were the only ones awake on this, you know, 24-hour trip. But what it's cutting to or from is from the sequence where Siddhartha is going to go leave the palace for the last time on his journey.
Yes.
Yeah, this is what leaving the wife back in Seattle is really all about. Siddhartha, which is also like one of the things that I find sort of questionable about the story of Siddhartha, is that he realizes he wants to attain enlightenment, and he has to do that by going out into the world, living in poverty
and dumping his wife, just like Dean.
Yeah, that's the part that it's me from my life experiences that I really don't approve of Siddhartha in his story, is that he left his position as prince. He left the palace, but it wasn't like he wasn't married or anything yet. He was married. He leaves on, I believe, the night that his wife gives birth to their son. And he,
yeah,
will not, he knows that, like, it would be such a, and I mean, and this is not the fault of the movie. This is kind of just my finding fault in this story in general, is that he cannot embrace his newborn son, because then he would fall in love with his son and then want to stay. So instead, he has to leave that night, and he's going off to become enlightened. Everyone else, except he wakes up his one friend, but everyone else in the palace is asleep. This is all mirroring what Dean and the son are doing, that they are going to go off, on a similar journey, and they have to leave the wife alone, which I know why they did this. Like, there's no reason you couldn't have the whole family.
The dean's
go.
Taking his son, so the whole formula.
You're
is
right. That part.
Then.
That part doesn't
like,
even work. Yeah.
But the other piece is okay. Drawing these parallels to what end? Like, what value is gained from structuring your film like that, other than being like, look, white people, you too can be like Buddha.
And that's a possibility. I think also part of it is because ultimately the film is set it up with this Evan story, if we can even call it that, that, you know, Dean is the one who really needs to transform and change. And the problem is the script is so shoddy that, I mean, it poorly sets up. Like, Lisa only ends up objecting to it so that Dean can be on his quest.
Yeah, and let's not forget that basically that's the last real moment that Lisa has in the film.
Yeah, she's gone then, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, she does an immediate reversal to set up a narrative thread, and then she is gone.
Yeah.
I do like the idea of the film ultimately being Dean's transformation. Now, it would be a lot more interesting if he accidentally went into the matter teleporter with, say, a housefly.
Jesus. You know,
that's not the film we got here.
No. What we get instead is, yes.
Buddha fly. There. Got it. Yeah.
There we go.
But
we did it, boys.
And this podcast has now been banned in the following countries. Point being that in this instance, yes, once they get there, Dean irresponsibly leaves his child to go wandering off on his own, where he ends up encountering the young, one of the other candidates who may be the reincarnation. In this instance, hopefully I'm pronouncing this correctly, Raju, played by an actor by the name of Raju Lai, if I'm hoping I'm pronouncing it correctly in this instance. The key thing here is, oh boy, where do we even start with...
Oh, precocious street urchin, one of my favorite archetypes.
Yeah, he's kind of a slightly more authentic Disney Aladdin is what he is, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, he's one swing ahead of the sword. Yeah, because we see him like dancing in an open market bazaar. And then he entertains the people. Jesse walks up and they basically haggle over money. And it happens that Jesse has a Game Boy. So Raju ends up taking it because he's the...
Well, his...
What does he say?
His brother ends up taking it after Raju plays for a while and is quite good at it. And I would just like to know, I want to know which Nintendo executive was fired for basically cutting this product placement deal for the last, Little Buddha. Because you just know, it's like, yeah, kids are going to go nuts for it when they see this movie. Oh, poor.
To be fair, though, he is playing Tetris, which for the longest time was the best-selling video game in the world.
Fair point.
And also because Alexei Pajitnov did not get to own the rights, he made no money off of it. So intellectual property rights matter. Stay tuned to the end of the episode when I cover another pop song.
But yes,
I guess all that to say, though, is like this is when it feels like a different movie the film could have been, where if it was just framed as Jesse coming to Kathmandu and then bonding with the other two plucky youths, like it feels like it's setting that up. But like this is in the last 20 minutes of the film. So, like, I don't know. I see what they're trying to do, but again, it's trying to do too many things and doing them at very strange junctures of the film. But it all sets up that the important thing is that Raju is also a candidate to be the reborn teacher, and the monks see it as a good sign because, well, of all the people that could have bumped into each other, these two did.
Yeah. They also then end up meeting up with Gita, played by Grishma Makar Singh, again, hopefully pronouncing it correctly, who is...
I think that was fine.
But she is the third candidate for the possible reincarnation, and again, in this one, she is the... She's the one who's been clearly already is aware of the religion, who has some experience with
the haughty one.
Yes. And it's like, yes, yes, I know what I'm doing. You two aren't even necessarily going to be able to keep up with this. Well, the important thing is that, yeah, basically all the other kids are just types at this point in time. And the point, though, of getting them all together is ultimately they hear the conclusion of the Siddhartha story, where basically he undergoes his testing on his road to enlightenment. And this is probably the most striking sequence visually in the film, where basically, yeah, we see effectively a series of challenges and tests that Siddhartha is put through by... effectively, again, I'm not sure of the name of the figure itself, or I can't remember it offhand.
Are you thinking of Mara?
Yes, thank you. Who is basically there to sort of throw...
Played by Mara Wilson.
He's lying.
Oh, no, that's a different movie, too. Yes.
But in this instance, basically, yes, what's happening here is it's a testing of Siddhartha at this point in time, trying to throw him off. Again, almost like, again, to draw religious parallels with Christianity, the temptations of Christ when he's in the desert there. So effectively, in this instance, though, he comes through. But again, as stage, we see a blending of the different planes of the story going on, where the kids are basically interacting with what's going on here and witnessing this like it's a firsthand account. And the shots that Bertolucci is setting up here are staggering in this instance. Like, they are just gorgeously filmed, and some of the more abstract and almost expressionistic in terms of how they're staged comparatively to everything else. And again, the effects work that's done here is very subtle and nuanced, and again, featuring some sort of digital morphs on screen that are actually better than you would anticipate for 1993.
And better than they were in The Devil's Advocate last week.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, but what's so... I don't want to say that it necessarily drags this part down, but like, you get some very inventive cinematography and some very well-realized effects. But you have to remember that the entire point of this scene is the Siddhartha showing his resolve in the face of temptation. So ultimately, this entire scene, though, is predicated around Mara doing these spectacular things while Reeves just sits there stoically.
You're not wrong, but boy, is it well-filmed stoic sitting. So
yeah, that's true. I mean, I'll take it over Soy Cuba most days of the week.
Yeah. But I mean, the key thing here is with the story completed at this point, what we end up finding is, yeah, the film sort of quickly moves, at least as quickly in term relative to the rest of this movie, the wrap up where, yes, it's basically the monks come to the conclusion that all three children are in part reincarnations of their former teacher, with basically different aspects of them having been gifted to each of them in this instance. And while this is going on and we're seeing sort of religious ceremonies built around the recognition of this, we have what's going on with Norbu here, who apparently, yes, is suffering from film illness and dying bit by
filmness.
Yes, in this instance. Our go-to example for nondescript diseases, which may or may not be killing individuals. Again, see Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li, amongst others.
No, better yet, don't see it.
Yeah, but the key thing here is that, yeah, as this is going on, we see Dean sort of dealing one-on-one with Norbu about this and sort of reflecting on the aspect of death, because as we all know, his good friend Evan, you know, that weighs heavily on his conscience, I guess. So yeah, basically from this, the rest of the film is, and again, this is where I kind of feel awkward about this movie, because on one hand, basically nothing in terms of on-screen events is really happening. Like, it's not like this is an action-filled climax. It's basically monks going up to children and recognizing, yeah, this is who you are, this is a part of you, and we're going to acknowledge this, and we'll talk to you some more about this, while another old man dies while Dean watches, and ostensibly the kids see his spirit, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not really sure if that's what's happening towards the end there or not, but again, the kids end up having different aspects of their teacher now. And over as the film comes to a close, we see the kids in different spots sort of releasing the ashes of Norbu back into the different parts of the world. The Seattle, basically into the ocean, into the air, and along this tree on the ground. So I feel awkward as we come to the end, only because while the film is not eventful, I kind of feel I'm digging the gentleness of this movie in a roundabout way, where it's not filled with false drama necessarily, although that does translate into a complete absence of drama as we're going.
Well, I mean, like, as a point of comparison, like, Ozu films.
Yeah.
If anyone who enjoys Japanese cinema, there are films like Tokyo Story, which are very tranquil, very meditative films that are well shot and just, they spool out, and there's something very lyrical about them. This is a film that aims to be lyrical in the context of framing itself as a story being told to its audience. And so it's just, there's a lot of things that this film tries to do. I just feel like it doesn't make them gel together. And so, yeah, like, it is a pleasant film, and I don't think there is anything wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But I think as far as that kind of cinema goes, this is a relatively poor example of it.
Yeah, the whole sequence at the end, you're right. Like, it's probably a letdown as a film. To me, again, like, everything, like, oh, they're trying to teach these various lessons. For, like, one thing, like you said, Lama Norbu, what he's doing there is he's going into a room to just sit down quietly, maybe with some friends watching him, and he's going to go die. What they're really doing there is calling attention to the idea of what would eventually become self-mummification. You might actually read this on the news every so often. Every once in a while, someone might find a new treasure somewhere in a Buddhist monastery or in a statue of a Buddha, and they'll do an x-ray and say, well, wait a second, there's actually a skeleton inside of this thing. And they don't always have to be hidden inside statues, but a lot of monks, as to show, there have been monks who will, I'm either dying or I want to go ahead and I'm essentially going to commit suicide, and it essentially turns their body holy. And so then a monastery can have a relic of a, basically there's a monk in his robes and he's sitting upright, and people can pray to that monk. That's what, but yeah, there's a fault there that they don't explain that that's what Norbu is. Even if he's not actually doing, that is definitely, I could recognize immediately, oh, this is what they're trying to bring attention to, is this idea of he is going to die while sitting in a meditative pose. And then if the monastery wanted, they could then embalm his body and like keep it around.
Okay,
but like,
just as a holy relic.
The issue is in not explaining that, though. You have a film that at one and the same time expects the audience to have zero understanding of Buddhism and also be aware of inside baseball.
Yeah, someone should have told Dean, like, this is probably what he's doing.
Yeah, like, you could have the most ham-handed exposition of, what's that monk over there doing? Oh, it's a sacred ritual. Because this film explains everything else. Except Evan.
Yeah.
Yeah. The business of the three children. So it turns out, they say that the three children are each different aspects of their deceased master, Dorje. And that's an interesting idea. And I tried to investigate, like, well, is this a thing? How common is this? And I couldn't really find any answers on that, on how common it is. But I want to tell both of you, like, the business of the master being named Dorje, the late master being called Dorje, and there being three candidates who all are all sort of proven right, that they are all in their own way reincarnations of this lama. Bertolucci and the writers actually took some stuff that was sort of current in the news at the time.
Yes.
And I will just look at my notes real quick.
Because there was a child from Seattle who, about a year after the release of this film, was noted as being a reincarnation of a Buddhist monk. And yeah, apparently,
so sometimes life imitates art.
Okay, yeah. So there's a case like that where, like you say, like a Seattle child, which is probably where they're getting, like, oh, let's get in a white child in this to tell the story to everyone. Like, okay, we see what you're doing. Okay. Which also, by the way, inspired an episode of King of the Hill.
Of course.
If anyone out there remembers, there was a King of the Hill episode where they think that in their town, a llama might have been reincarnated there. So they get a lot of the children. So they get some of the Laotian children, including, I forget the girl's name. What was the girl's name on?
Was it Luann?
No, but Bobby's sometimes girlfriend. Yeah. Connie Jr. Because the dad named his own daughter after him. Yes. Connie Jr. That she's a candidate. And so is Bobby. He's also a candidate. And so that whole episode becomes a bit of a joke on that story, but also on this movie. So there's that. But no, at the time, Dorje is a name that means if you ever see a Buddhist statue of, there's a little item, and it looks like a very tiny staff, and it's supposed to represent both a lightning bolt and a diamond. It's very difficult to explain. So if you put in Dorje, D-O-R-J-E.
Oh, the one that kind of looks like a shepherd's crook?
No, this one is very, very small. It's just a handheld object, but it represents the diamond as in sort of strength and how basically the indestructibility of your soul, but also the lightning as in enlightenment and also being able to achieve the Buddha state, any state of nirvana, is very much in one lifetime is like being flashed with lightning. That it's an incredible feat, and like there's light everywhere, but also like to attain this in one lifetime is like a flash of lightning. But anyway, but Dorje, but in when this is another lineage of a Tibetan monk who keeps on being reincarnated called the Karmapa. In 1981, the Karmapa then, his name was Dorje, and he died. And his school sort of split in two, and there were two different candidates, not from America, but there were two different candidates of these children at the time who are both, these are both people in around our age now. They are in their 30s. And so his school split in two, and there are now today two monks who both claim to be the Karmapa, to claim to be this reincarnated person and this teacher. And it's interesting to see this. There you go. Like Buddhism, there's just as much politics and there is just as much nuance as any other religion.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was going to say that my school split in two, but to be fair, it was a pretty serious earthquake. But like, I think that goes to what you're saying, Ross, is that these stories feel so much more lived in, or I guess compatible with our reality, because they come from that. Whereas, you know, telling those stories is very interesting, and they can explore like the basic 101 of Buddhism and still deliver an interesting narrative. Whereas, kind of by contrast, what we see in this film really comes off more like pablum.
Yeah, that's closer to what they ended up with. But it was just, sorry, maybe you're not always as interested in the backstory stuff, but I saw that, oh, the writers and Bertolucci, they saw this story. That isn't that interesting that there were, they disagreed on who the reincarnated individual was, and they are still split today. This school that should be unified is split today, but there's a few people who say, no, they could both be the same reincarnated soul. So, but there's three different opinions on that. It's this guy, it's that guy, or it's, no, it's both of them. And it's interesting to me that it comes out in this movie, but as you're both saying, like, that doesn't make for necessarily a good or exciting movie.
Well, but there's also no conflict between the different candidates in this movie either. Like, we get sort of like, I'm more worthy of being the candidate than you, but that difference is resolved very quickly. And so we end up getting a very utopian idea of the idea of like sort of the split essence. Because what's the metaphor? Yeah, the water in the cup, yeah, where the cup can break, but tea.
Yeah.
The tea is still tea. And I mean, so I think, like, certainly the way that sort of three-part bifurcation of Master Dorje, like, I think that's certainly, like, plausible within how the film sets up its theology. I just think, like, it's, again, it's that well-meaningness where it's showing everyone can get along. Whereas I think just as a narrative, the idea that, well, no, even though we have a theistic system that can allow for these things in the real world, you know, this still very much does cause conflict and causes people to separate along sectarian lines.
You're right. The intent here of the movie is to have show Buddhism in a very nice light, which, fine, and they didn't give any thought to conflict between the parents and the monks. Really, I mean, like, a little bit of lip service is paid, yeah, to that. But like, well, like, just come on in, like, we'll leave our kid with you, all this sort of stuff. They didn't consider, we could have some conflict between the parents and the monks initially, or we could have some conflict between, more significant conflict between the children other than just Geeta being, you know, hey, boys, I know more than you. Yeah, that they didn't really consider how are we going to make the most interesting movie. It was more, oh, we want to represent Buddhism and this Tibetan tradition in a nice manner. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, that's the thing. I feel like I did come away learning at least a little bit more about Buddhism. I also learned why it's important not to finish construction on a building until you've leased out all the units. Dave, Little Buddha, I don't know if there's a whole lot more to say about this other than there is nothing more frustrating than a film that means so well.
Well, yeah, that's basically it. I mean, it might be worth a watch if you're just curious or you're a Bertolucci completist, but that's about the extent of it, really, with this one.
Well, as a 101 piece, though, I think it's certainly a decent, non-controversial introduction to Buddhism.
Yeah.
That's really where its value is, in the same way that I am not an expert on, frankly, of any religion movies. But, you know, I remember seeing some Sunday school cartoons or a movie every once in a while. And like, this is at about that level in that, like here, it's a nice production. We're going to teach you some things. It's unfortunate about Keanu Reeves casting. And yeah, if for some reason you wanted to learn a few things or you wanted to show this to, I don't know why, like I'm assuming if you're a parent or someone who has an interest in Buddhism, you would get one of those books that Jesse has in this movie and just tell the story. But if you really wanted to go the next step, like, that's really where the value of this movie is, in like, here, everyone, here's something that's almost basically an educational movie. Yeah.
Yeah, an educational movie with financial ruin and suicide. Don't forget shape-shifting demons. But I guess, yeah, considering how much is going on all throughout this film, that probably behooves us to turn to our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits, where we celebrate the little things that make us grin and groan in, well, equal or asymmetrical measure. So, Ross, as our guest, why don't you start us off? What is your first hit for Bertolucci's Little Buddha?
For Little Bertolucci. my hit is going to be, and I'm probably going to steal it from both of you, probably the cinematography by Vittorio Storaro. Yeah, again, Storaro, I think we're all saying Storaro, maybe, yeah. So he also, he won the Academy Award for cinematography for Apocalypse Now and Last Emperor. And this, again, like I brought up several times that in a lot of ways to me, this is best compared to Last Emperor, and it's not quite as grand or as quite as nice looking as it, except for the sequence with the demon Mara. But it's generally a nice looking film. Even in my hit, though, I have to put a pit within that. I've got to add in. Yeah. You know what I'm going to get to is that the light, the coloring of it, which I kind of assumed there was some filtering or something going on, because even pre-digital, I assumed there was some treatment you could do for film, that the Seattle sequence is all in blue, and we know why they're doing it. We know why it's represented that way, but I wish you can tone this down. Like, there are other colors. You can show this a bit more naturalistic, but on the whole, what they're showing on the screen is very impressive and cool to look at. And also, everyone, this is also the same cinematographer as Dick Tracy.
Yes.
Ooh. Which, I mean, there you go. Like for, if you talk about, again, what is the value of Dick Tracy? It's probably in like the art direction, the costumes, and the cinematography. Like, those are probably where you start with, like, this is what's the good experience about Dick Tracy the movie is.
I don't know. I think there's a lot of value in a character that also roughs up bums and, you know.
Well, you never get to see that. The shack just shakes back and forth. Like, Dick Tracy's really beating up that guy inside that shack that's about to fall down. But yeah, but like, so Storaro, so he's very impressive. He's impressive in this movie. So you talked about, you guys talked about, like, hey, there's no conflict. I don't think there's ever a fight in a physical fight in this movie, but there are some interesting imagery to see. Yeah. So that is my hit.
Nice.
All right. In lieu, Dave, I'm going to jump in because if you steal mine, then I have literally nothing left to say.
Sure.
So I am going to also do a split pick, which is a hit and pit at the same time as well. And that is The Score by Ryuichi Sakamoto.
Yes.
Who is a long, long performing, largely electronic musician, formerly with the Yellow Magic Orchestra. I have Sakamoto on my phone that I listen to. I enjoy his work as a composer. This is a very good score. I just find that tonally, it doesn't always match up, particularly with the Seattle scenes. And like some of those early sequences, you listen to the score, and with that dark blue filtering, you almost get this sense of foreboding. And that's why I genuinely spent a little while of this movie being like, is this going to be like a home invasion film? So it's a great score to listen to. It just doesn't always line up with the movie that it's made for.
Yeah. I mean, if they'd only gone with the original composer, Junkie XL, I'm sure it would have been totally...
Yeah, they'd have even more blue filtering too.
Absolutely. But no, I'm
release the Snyder cut of Little Buddha.
But I'm absolutely in agreement with you. I mean, I didn't find it as out of touch with the film necessarily, or out of sync with it as you necessarily did, Andrew. I find it very calming and soothing, actually. I found the music extremely enveloping in this instance. So I'm completely in agreement with you, though, that taken even on its own, it is probably the best component of this film, hands down. So with that, I guess it behooves me to at least give us our final hit here. I'm going to fire off and give it actually to Ying Yuchun for his performance as Norbu. Because, again, he gives a very dignified performance in this film. I mean, he's not, like, nothing about what he's asked to do feels like he's being told to act in a stereotypical or caricature way. I mean, he's just a very pleasant, nice old man who's trying to carry out his mission. There's no overacting on his part. I mean, he has a nice chemistry with Chris Isaac once they get into the latter half of the film, certainly, where, yeah, it just becomes the sort of back and forth between the two. So, I mean, I think he's a really strong presence that holds this movie together. And I know we didn't give much lip service to him over the description of the plot, mainly because it's not really driven by him, and his involvement is...
Yeah, he's like the... In the heroic journey archetype, he's very much like the assister. He's the benevolent old sage that leads everyone
down.
He's
totally Obi-Wan.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
But he is very... He's very warm and he's fun about it. I do like him much more than Chris Isaac and Bridget Fonda and their undiagnosed bipolarity.
Yeah.
I was going to say he is very much Obi-Wan Kenobi. Even like Obi-Wan, he sort of dies at the end, but the idea is
he comes back stronger.
That is what he is. Yeah. He is totally, a force ghost. Yeah. When you talk about the earnestness of this movie, there you go. The starring monk gets to be earnest, and it makes the most sense with him. So while he's a very accomplished actor, he's doing excellent at his job. Like it makes sense that his role would come off the best in this. Yeah.
So this makes Chris Isaac Uncle Owen, right? Just we're all on the same page here.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I just got it. Ernest goes to Kathmandu.
God.
So do we have any pits that we want to raise that we didn't earlier? I think we picked out the big one, well, the big two, that despite being written by Rudy Wurlitzer, no one involved with the script seemed to know what they were doing, and Keanu Reeves is wearing brown face.
Yeah, you got anything extra, Ross?
My pit was actually going to be, like, I agree, like, Chris Isaac does not come off well at all in this movie, but you know what, like backhanded compliments, my pit was actually going to be it is the script, specifically their dialogue, between in the family, that everything is a lot of the drama is supposed to be on an intellectual level. I am upset that my coworker Evan committed suicide. Well, he doesn't even say that, right? But like that's why I'm upset, or like we can't allow this to happen to our son. Like it's they're basically not real people. And so you know what? Like even the child actor who I didn't take note of what the actor who he is. And like you know he comes off as standard child actor. Like he's fine. But there you go. Like even. I don't know if he's a particularly a better or worse actor or not, because I think kind of almost every actor in this movie kind of rises to the level that the script requires them. And because the mom and dad and the son is a son, and the mom and the dad are so undercooked that Chris Isaac comes off as pretty bad. But you know what? Like I'll shift some of the blame away from him, because like I think he kind of played to the level of where the dialogue was.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and it seems like like we've been over this before, where it's like you can't have a great performance if the script isn't there to help you out. The same way that like you can write the most amazing script, but if you miscast the actor, you can only do so much with it. Here, it's like, well, it's a pretty okay performance of a pretty middling dialogue that he's given. So, I mean, I would agree that the issues with the performance aren't entirely on Chris Isaac's shoulders, because he has shown in other films that he can act, and, certainly films like Fire Walk With Me, he does show that he has a pretty impressive range up until the moment he disappears.
So,
I don't know, though. Dave, what about you? Anything to single out here?
Just to build off of, I'd say that the Pietro Scalia's editing might be partly to blame. Like, the actual transitions in a lot of sequences are excellent, including the sort of climactic part of the Siddhartha storyline. But, I get the feeling that when we talk to things like Evan's gone bankrupt, like there's probably another like 10 to 15 minutes that have been shaved out of this movie that probably expands a little bit on this. And this has just sort of been cut to the bone in certain sequences. Now, whether that's Scalia's fault or whether he's basically following the dictates that were coming from up on above, it's hard to say so. But that's about the extent of it for me.
Yeah, I'm almost wishing that they did a Big Short style scene where it just cuts to Dean being like, oh yeah, my business partner Evan killed himself. We don't talk about that. And then it just never comes up again.
Yeah.
You're probably right that there are more scenes talking about Evan, but here's my guess. Like, he's probably never in the office. That Dean probably goes into the office like, Evan, where are you? Oh, you're making coffee? Okay, he's just this unseen character. Just very mysterious.
Turns out Evan's been dead.
Oh, sorry. Evan just stepped out.
Evan's been dead for 4 to 5 weeks and nobody noticed. Of course he went bankrupt. Nobody was holding it. Oh, God.
Well, thank God that they didn't cut off the AC until Tuesday. Okay, and on that note, for a very earnest movie, corpse refrigeration jokes. So, Ross, thank you very much for joining us. It's...
Well, thank you for having me on for this joke episode. Jeez, thanks, guys.
Wow, I like to think that we were surprisingly fair and even-handed until we brought up the idea of Evan. So, you made this episode a little bit more nuanced than it would have been otherwise, and we salute you for that.
Well, thank you for having me, yeah.
In return, what would you like to use this wonderful platform that we've given you to promote?
Well, as you guys are driving up to that gas station in the distance and telling me apparently I need to get a bus to ride back home. Thanks. Okay. But as we drive up to the gas station, usually I'm talking about Ivan Reitman films. My podcast is called Reitman for the Job. I update it when I feel like it. But I did a Halloween episode. I'll be back for a holiday episode. And then in the new year, we're getting real back into, Ivan Reitman's filmography with Heavy Metal and Ghostbusters.
Oh, your favorites. Not enough people talk about Heavy Metal.
And thanks, yeah, I don't have entirely complimentary things to say about it, but there you go. Heavy Metal is a very interesting movie to talk about. Yes. Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Man. Well, Very much looking
forward. So take care, guys, and drive safe.
Thank you.
And thank you. And
I can play to the bit. See ya. Okay, off I go into the gas station.
Oh, bye. Before you go, why don't you tell us your Twitter handle?
Oh, there's that too. It's at Ross May Ryder.
All right.
Take care, guys. I'm going to go get on this bus. It's leaving.
All right. Make sure you take a left at Albuquerque. So, Dave, speaking of detours, while I fill up the tank, I'm not extending this metaphor further. What are we going to be looking at next week? We've gone from Satan to Buddha. So what's up next for us?
More Italian art cinema, because we're going to be following Bertolucci and Vittorio Storaro, both back to the early 1970s for The Conformist, their breakout movie together. So yeah, take a look for that next week. It's been a doozy.
Yeah, learn more about Italian art cinema, learn about the rise and fall of fascism. Sounds like just another day in the office for our podcast about cinema. So for those keeping score, we've gone Satan, Buddha, and now coming up on Fascist Italy. So, just in time for Christmas. So, Dave, where can people get in touch with you?
You can find me at 24 Panels there. I am happy to have a very civil conversation and entertain any notions about visiting Pazuzu in the near future. What about you, Andrew?
You can find me at Film Stripper, and I'm down to party. I'll talk about anything. In the meantime, you can also talk to us about anything by emailing our show at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. And our website that I forgot to mention at the top of the episode yet again can be found at filmstripspodcast.home.blog, where you can find our full episode archive, our listener's guide, as well as links to friends of the show. Yeah, and as always, feel free to check us out on iTunes or whatever podcasting service you use, presumably the one you use to find this show right now. And feel free to rate and review us. 5-star reviews help move us up the featured charts and get more eyes and ears onto our show. And by the look of it, I would say that, did we ever come up with a name for our fan base?
No, we didn't.
All right, the celluloiderers have been turning out in droves and bring a lot of new listeners to our show by recent metrics. So thank you all so much for spreading the word. And above all, please do let us know what you think, because we want to bring you the kind of show that you want to listen to.
Absolutely. So with that, Andrew, are there any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Why, yes, David, there are. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
After all, what do you think happened to Evan?
Really? No rebirth pun?
Looking out a dirty old window, devil of the cars in the city go rushing by. I sit here alone and I wonder why. Friday night and everyone's moving, I can feel the heat but it's soothing, heading down. I search for the beat in this dirty town. Downtown the young ones are going, downtown the young ones are growing. We're the kids in America.
Whoa.
We're the kids in America.
Whoa.
Everybody live for the music around.